Psalm 105. You know, of course, that in the divine wisdom of the lectionary, the Old Testament lessons after Easter are from the book of Acts, which isn't, I suppose, quite as bizarre as it may seem, since now they are called the first lesson. One could make the point, I guess, the reason for that is they thought this was a way to get in some stuff out of Book of Acts. Otherwise, you never do Acts if you're going to do a gospel and an epistle. You can also make the point that all those great sermons in the Book of Acts all have Old Testament texts, and that's not a bad reminder. However, for our purposes here in reading an Old Testament text, we've traditionally switched from the lesson to the psalm, the appointed psalm to be read. And for a few weeks, you get a good sampling of some psalms, and that's not bad either. Otherwise, you don't do psalms in the lectionary. So here we go. Now, again, almost all psalms, except for Good Shepherd Sunday, when you do Psalm 23, are done in part and not in whole. And that's kind of like singing two verses of a six-verse hymn, when maybe, just maybe, the guy that wrote the hymn thought that you should read the whole thing. That maybe verse 2 leaves you hanging and verse 6 brings it on home. Even if it's long and slow and Lenten, you can still sing six verses of a hymn. So you're always stuck kind of doing half the job. But there's enough here anyway. Oh, and some great forms. All right, we're in Psalm 105, if I read the program correctly. Hodul Yahweh, kir u b'shmo. Hey, you can actually translate this stuff, and we've had these verbs now, even those guys in beginning Hebrew. Hodu, from yada, first yod, third hey. These are great roots. The hey is hifil. You only have one regular root letter left, and that's the daleth. Now, this form is ambiguous. It could be perfect, they gave thanks, or it could be imperative, your choice. Duh. What do you think it is here? Well, if you didn't figure it out by the time you got the L-Yahweh, you should by the time you get the Kir-U, because Kir-U is not ambiguous. It is clearly Kal, what? Imperative, right? So that tips you off that you've got an imperative at the beginning as well. So what do we have? Give thanks to Yahweh, cry out b'shemo, in his name. This really is the technical idiom for invoke his name. Cry out in his name doesn't just mean to either cry out his name like Yahweh, 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 to make a statement sort of swearing by the name of Yahweh, but it means to invoke his name, to call his name, to be sort of the dominating principle, and even the presence. Remember, name and person are essentially the same concept, which is why, I mean, that's the whole point of the invocation at the beginning of our worship, too, that we begin this by putting it in the context of the presence of God. Not quite the same as good morning, or as Brouwer likes to call that, the holy howdy. Call out in his name, or invoke his name, there you go. Hodiu, well, let's stick with imperatives, we're on a roll. Hodiu, this is another first yod, yada, but now notice it's hifil. Cause someone to know. Now, here the someone, the first direct object, is lacking. And this becomes kind of an impersonal passive. To cause X to know something is to cause something to be known. So the hifil can use the second half of that cause X to do Y as a passive. And that's what you have here. Cause to be known, or cause somebody to know, Ba'amim, in the Ams, among the peoples, Aliloth Au, his Alilahs. And Alilah is an action, a fairly neutral term for something done. So cause among the nations some people to know, or cause to be known, his deeds. Two, Shir'u lo. Shir, didn't we have this last week or when we did Exodus 15? They sang a song, and that's the word shir, but here it's the hollow root in the imperative. Sing lo to him. Zamru lo. Here again you see this zamar as the word for sing, though it originally had this meaning of strength and power, and we talked about that when we did Exodus 15 last week, and we talked about that when we did Isaiah 12, which quotes Exodus 15 about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So this verb is tracked, followed us around, and here it is again. Here it's clearly a parallel to shear, and I think indicates that it certainly means sing. But maybe sing with strength. I don't know. Jim, you had a theory on sort of how that may have moved historically as words tend to do, like bar, from an original meaning to sort of a derived meaning. So sing praise, sing out because of his strength, I guess could be implied, lo to him. Siku bekal niflothau. Siku, another imperative of the hollow root seek, which you probably don't know. If it's any comfort, I didn't either. I looked this up. Seek actually means, you can guess, it has something to do with either sing or speak out or tell, paralleling the previous line. It really has the, I mean, it's fairly rare, but it really means to ramble on. it doesn't just mean speak, but it means, in fact, the noun, sika, can mean even babble, like somebody, you just say, okay, enough already. I don't know how much of that you want to bring in here, but it implies more than just say it once, you see. Keep on talking about Niflothau, his Nifloth. Now, this is really from the Niphal form of Pala. Pala means to be marvelous, wonderful, in the true sense of wonder. This is the closest word you have to sort of a real supernatural concept, something not ordinarily explained, hence extraordinary. Talk about all his wonders. Fair enough? The same word you get is in wonder counselor in Isaiah 9, that wonderful counselor guy, which again has pretty much been lost in English today. Hith hallelu, praise yourselves. The hith pael here of halal is a little awkward. I can't mean praise yourselves, but praise almost with reference to yourselves. That this has something to do with you, I think, would be the implication. Praise in the name of his holiness, Kodesh Kodsho. Praise in the name of his holiness. Yismach Lev. Yismach looks like regular imperfect, and it probably is, except all of these are imperatives. If suddenly you have a third person imperfect in a string of imperatives, and the form is ambiguous so that it could also be jussive, it probably is. Let the heart, and I think this is a construct chain, let the heart of the mivakashe, the pal participle of bakash, right? The seeking ones. Bakash means to seek out. Let the heart of the seekers of Yahweh rejoice. Get it? The heart of the seekers of Yahweh rejoice. By the way, a minor grammatical point. If this is PL, where's the dagish in the middle root letter? Right? You should find a dagish in the middle root letter unless it's a guttural, which it is not. The answer to that question is it's not there. Begging the question, why isn't it there? The answer is because there's a vocal schwa under it. Lots of times that dagish forte just falls out before vocal schwa, which is a bit unfortunate to students who have depended on that dagish forte. Verse 4, Dir Shu Yahweh, Va'uzo. Dir Shu, Kal, imperative. Do you see that's the same form as the third word in the very beginning of the psalm? Imperative, Kal. Darash is a synonym of Bakash, to seek. Seek Yahweh, Va'uzo, and his Uz. This is usually Uz with Kamatz Katuf, strength. Seek Yahweh in his strength. Bakashu, here's the straight PL, another PL, back to PL, because Bakash used the PL, and you'll notice the Dagish Forte shown up now even with a vocal schwa. Seek Panau, his face. Now, you get this translated, his face, and that's fair enough. Panau means his face. But remember, face doesn't just mean, you know, that fore part of your head on which you generally recognize people by the shape of their eyes, nose, mouth. Face essentially means presence. Seek, so I mean you could translate that even though that's not literal. Seek his presence. Tamid is an adverb, continually, constantly. 5. Zikru, another kal imperative, remember, niflo thou, we just had this, didn't we, at the end of verse 2. Remember his wonders, asher asah, which he has done. Mofathau, his mofoth, that's written defectively. A mofoth is a synonym for a nifla, another kind of wonder. Again, sort of miraculous deed. Powerful deed, his wonders. I don't know. I can't think of better English synonyms. His wonders and the mishpate pi, and the mishpats of construct plural. The mishpats of pi, his mouth. Remember, pi is really from pei, but with a both in the construct form and with pronominal suffixes, it gets this extra yod in there. Really, the third hey changes to yod, or the final hey is shown up as a yod. So P with the wow at the end that doesn't get pronounced is just his mouth. The judgments of his mouth, whatever that means. When has God given the judgments of his mouth? Well, lots of times, I guess. Anything he speaks is, in a sense, a mishpat. Now you skip two verses, which is always dangerous. In fact, we could run through them real quick. The seed of Abraham, his servant, the sons of Jacob, his chosen ones. Who, Yahweh Eloheinu? Now, this frankly shouldn't be skipped. This is kind of an exclamation. He is Yahweh, our God. In all the earth are his mishpats. Verse 8, Zakar. This is now the next verse in the assigned lectionary. You wonder why skip just two verses here. That's just stupid. And it's not like they're that long. They're actually rather significant verses. Now you'll notice that there is at least one footnote or suggestion that a few manuscripts based on a similar psalm in First Chronicles, have not Zakar here, but Zikru, which would continue the imperative, remember his covenant. However, if you read it Zakar, it's not imperative, but perfect third singular masculine, and the subject is Yahweh. Which theologically is much better, and therefore no doubt the right reading. I was waiting for Veltz to cringe there. this is principle number 3 of text criticism. He is Yahweh our God. In all the earth are his judgments. He has remembered le'olam beritho. He has remembered forever his covenant. The word he commanded, well, all right, you see, tsuwa is also in the third person. The word he commanded to a thousand generation. Now, this is probably, again, the idiom of the thousandth generation, similar to what you have in the so-called close of the commandments, which, of course, comes at the beginning of the commandments, about doing chesed to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. That's the same theme here. And you'll notice it's here essentially a synonym for le'olam, which kind of means into perpetuity as much as is necessary and as long as time continues. So you don't count to 1,000 and say, time's up, any more than you count to 144,000 and say, no more. And that's the whole point of these numbers. So verse 8 reads, he has remembered forever his covenant, the word he commanded to the thousandth generation. And then it goes on and talks about this covenant, but here's the end of the text. Now, you should at least read through the rest of the psalm and realize that what we have here is kind of a recounting or recital of God's history of salvation to the patriarchs, how they came down to Egypt, and how God brought them out of Egypt. So what does it mean to seek the Lord and remember what he has done and to tell of his wonders in all the earth is little more than to recite God's acts of salvation for his people. And that's the testimony that we bring, all right? And frankly, in the wake of Easter, this seems relatively self-evident, but this comes up now as the first Sunday after Easter, which is probably a good time. The trouble is the people who need to hear this sermon won't be there. The Sunday after Easter is sort of apart from the dog days of August, probably your lowest attendance Sunday in the year. And all those who just celebrated what he has done aren't there the next day to continually seek the Lord and keep recounting all he has done. But that's what we do. And that tamid, I think, at the end of verse 4 is a significant word here. Jim, you want to make a comment? Well, now that's interesting. I was taking it as a subsequent object.
That's what I mean.
Which you're right. That's the way I took it. Now, and your way works too. Do you see his question? Does verse 8 read, he has remembered forever his covenant, comma, he has remembered the word which he commanded, and now you have to read silwa as kind of a clipped relative clause, to the thousandth generation? Or do you just read them as two statements? He has remembered his covenant forever. He has commanded a word to the thousandth generation. How does that make sense? Yeah, you're proposing a third alternative. Unfortunately, yours doesn't work. But that's why you're there and we're here. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you could say it's third singular masculine, but what does it mean for a word has commanded, unless you want to read Christology into this? But I'm afraid only certain people in the Missouri Synod are wont to do that. Yeah, right. The theology of the best reading? Yeah, right. Well, okay, we better quit. I think we've finished the text, at least. A lot more you could say.